Aiden and Ethan were born 4 minutes apart. They're twins, but the U.S. government says they're not the same.
It was literally black and white on paper. Your kids are different. One is a U.S. citizen at birth, the other is not.
The parents say that's because they're a same-sex couple. I'm Ari Shapiro. That story on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen today at 4 on KTOO.
Tonight on 360 North at 8, Evening at Egan, Power and Privilege, History and Healing, looks at institutional racism and cultural trauma through the story of a community where an elementary school was built on sacred burial ground. Cold Climate Building Techniques follows at 9:38. Gavel Alaska's daily coverage of legislative meetings resumes at 10. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org. Get updates on Facebook and Twitter.
Good afternoon. It's a Juno afternoon here on a Friday, and I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. Today we're going to be talking to Brian Buma about Alaska's oldest ecological land study. That's going to be tonight's Friday fireside lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. We're going to get an update on Catholic Community Services ongoing stuff, and we're going to be hearing about their upcoming gala, Classy and Sassy. We're going to meet a whole bunch of exchange students in town, and then we're going to talk to members of the Thunder Mountain High School drama, debate, and forensics team. That's all coming up, plus bird note music and more right here on this edition of A Juno Afternoon. Coming up first, we're going to be hearing from National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The number of First Nations reserves with long-term drinking water advisories has increased as the Canadian government works to improve water quality. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The numbers have gone from 67 at the end of last year to 91, which makes Ottawa's pledge to eliminate all water advisories on remote reserves by early 2021. The reason for the increase, according to the Minister of the New Indigenous Services Ministry, is that her department has taken on responsibility for more systems with long-term water advisories. The department now looks after more than 1,000 public drinking systems, an increase of about 25%. Jane Philpott is the Minister for Indigenous Services.
This isn't work that can be done in a short time span. We're talking about unique water systems that have to be designed in some of the most remote communities in the country. It takes work to design, develop, and construct those facilities. Sometimes it's complicated by having only certain times of the year that you can deliver construction equipment on winter roads or things in by a barge. You also need, of course, the funding for it. So we put close to $2 billion of new funding into this.
Philpott says about 40 reserves have had their boil water advisories lifted, and the government has earmarked nearly $2 billion over 5 years to fix and maintain on-reserve water and wastewater systems. Many reserves have been forced to find alternate sources of water, making it more difficult for basic daily needs such as bathing or even cooking dinner. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
State Senator and Northern Cheyenne Tribal Member Jason Small is part of an advisory committee tasked with helping southeastern Montana deal with the pending shutdown of two coal-fired power plants. The panel will hold its first meeting on Monday. Jackie Yamanaka of Yellowstone Public Radio reports.
I've got a lot of roots in the area. I'm definitely there. My guys are there. I'm raising a family in the area. I'm affected.
For many reasons. Small is a journeyman boilermaker and president of the trade union. He and many in his profession and region rely on the coal industry and the area's coal-fired power plants for jobs. The out-of-state owners of Colstrip Units 1 and 2 are planning to close these coal-fired generation units by 2022. Colstrip, a town of just over 2,000 residents according to the 2010 census, owes its existence to coal. The final death knell for the community came after voters in Oregon and Washington told utility regulators they didn't want their electricity to come from the burning of coal, and the plant's owners said the aging plants are no longer economically viable. As part of a shutdown settlement, one utility co-owner agreed to give the southeastern Montana community $10 million to soften the blow. State Senator Jason Small says the advisory committee will have to be creative.
You or I were given $10 million, well, heck, you're set the rest of your life. But, you know, when you start talking about workers that are coming from seven different towns in the area, or possibly a few more than that even, and the massive scale of people who are going to be affected, we're going to have to work some magic with $10 million to actually kind of make it happen.
Small Senate District includes the Northern Cheyenne and Crow reservations, where the unemployment is 3 to 4 times higher than the state's rate of just over 4%, according to the Montana Department of Labor and Industry. Coal and the area's coal-fired power plants are the major employers in the area. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Yamanaka in Billings, Montana.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Quantic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support great causes like National Native News. Just select KNBA-FM, Quantic Broadcast Corporation. With your support, you can help us make a difference in our community.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for KTOO is provided by Davies Berry Insurance, serving southeastern Alaska since 1917 with personal and commercial insurance, including homeowners, life, and health policies. 789-5900. Support comes from the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping you and your child save for college every step of the way, from diapers to diploma. More information at uacollegesavings.com.
And welcome back to the studios here at KTOO, and Andy Klein with you, hosting Juno Afternoon, joined right now by Brian Buma, who's going to be doing a fireside lecture tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, all about the world's oldest. Brian said the Alaska's oldest, which is true, but it's also the world's oldest ecological land study to happen right here in Alaska. So tell me where this occurred to start with.
Yeah, so I'll be talking about this study that's been going on in Glacier Bay for 101 years now. It's the world's oldest permanent plot network. It's the oldest study in the world studying vegetation change over time.
And you kind of described that when we were talking here about as succession. So it means one to the other, and how an environment can evolve over time.
Yeah, so it's explicitly designed to look at succession, and succession is that change in plant communities over time. And the study of succession is one of the first things ecologists in the United States were interested in looking at way back around 1900. And that's because it's one of the few things in the messy world of ecology that we live in that seems to be fairly predictable. It offers an opportunity to sort of make some predictions over time. And
so back in 1916, is it?
Yeah.
This pioneering guy, scientist, William Cooper, as you were describing, decided a great place to do that study would be here out in Glacier Bay.
Yeah, so William Cooper, he was in Minnesota, actually, and he actually worked on dunes on the Great Lakes for a little while, or his advisor did. But then he was in Alaska, and he was in the back of Glacier Bay, on a boat, just kind of touring around. And he thought, this is the perfect spot, to set up a long-term study. Because, one, no one was back there, so it was undisturbed. Two, he knew when the land emerged from the glacier, so he actually had a time zero. He could say, this is the beginning, and he could follow it through time without having to worry about what came before, how different the sites were, some unknown.
Right, so for 10,000 years or hundreds of thousands of years, this land has been under a gigantic chunk of ice, and now the glacier's receded.
Well, not part of Glacier Bay. The ice has retreated and advanced several times. It was retreating from its last maximum associated with the Little Ice Age, which was around the late 1700s. So it had been retreated since prior. But, of course, when a glacier rolls over, you know, there ain't much left.
Right.
So he was back there, and he knew – he actually worked with John Muir, or he was aware of John Muir's work, I should say, who did – mapped all the extents of glaciers back there. And so he knew exactly when the glaciers retreated and when that rock was exposed. And so he thought, this is a unique – and this is his exact words – what a unique opportunity to study how plant communities come together without outside interference of people or history or all sorts of things he couldn't control.
And then we'll talk a little bit about what he kind of discovered about that in a minute. But then describe to me the course of this experiment. Then he did this for a long time, and then he passed it off to another person who did it for a long time. And then something else happened. So is that, do I have that right?
That is true. Okay. Yeah. So he was a visionary guy. Cooper was a big thinker. He's actually one of the first presidents of the Ecological Society of America. He was very, very influential in the science. But even in his first paper, it says this study should go on longer than I can maintain it. And so in his very first paper, which about the 1916 trip, so he's writing in the early 1920s, he wrote directions down so anybody could go and try and find it. They weren't the best directions, and I'll go into that in the talk and how difficult it was to follow those directions. But he worked on those plots for about 30 years. And then, you know, he was getting up in years. And his graduate student, Donald Lawrence, took over and continued to go to the plots every year and go to these same spots and dutifully take down how plants were changing, what was there exactly, understanding the community, all the way up to the 1980s. And then, unfortunately, Donald Lawrence passed away in the early 1990s. And at that point, the plots were lost. This was pre-GPS. People had been going there, but they had always known how to get there, and so they had never written down the directions beyond what was written down in, you know, 1923.
So starting in 1986, this groundbreaking work that had been going on for, at that point, 70 years nonstop was interrupted.
Was lost. Yeah, exactly. So the last trip there was in 1988. And after that, yeah, it was done. Nobody that had been there picked up the torch, and essentially it sort of faded. And it didn't fade from memory or anything. Anybody who studies ecology knows these plots. They're still in textbooks today, but their actual locations were gone.
Until you came along.
until we got this crazy idea to assume that directions from 1916 were still easy to follow, which is not the case. So in 2016, so the 100th anniversary of Cooper installing these plots, I got a grant from National Geographic to go to Cooper's archives, look through his old notebooks, look through the old photographs, look through anything I could find in his archives, because his stuff is on archive in Minnesota, and then go out into Glacier Bay and try and rediscover these plots.
Now, how did you personally get fascinated with this idea and this story and pursuing this?
Well, as an ecologist, I'm very familiar with Cooper's work, because it really is one of the foundations of modern ecology. His studies, obviously the science has evolved since then, but they're foundational. I mean, they are the study you look at when you think about primary succession, which is plants coming onto recently deglaciated land, for example. So I was very much familiar with his work. And Glacier Bay in general has generated a lot of amazing ecological research, not just from Cooper, but many other very famous, well-known, and very brilliant scientists have worked in Glacier Bay. So being in Juneau, I was automatically sort of thinking about Glacier Bay. It's just an amazing place to work. And then 2015 rolled around, and I thought, well, I wonder what they're doing for this 100th year anniversary. And so I decided to look into it, and lo and behold, nobody even knew where the plots were. So then I started, you know, so who's going to go look for them? And no one's going to go look for them. And so, well, there you go.
There you go. Yeah. So you became a modern-day Indiana Jones in search. It's just like Indiana Jones, except less jewels and no Nazis.
And a lot more rain.
And a lot more rain. Yeah. A lot more rain.
Yeah, I even have a little yellow notebook.
Yes.
I have a little journal.
But it is exciting because, in a way, it of course, it combines the study that you have of ecology with archaeology, in a way. You're studying ancient maps to try to figure out where these plots are.
Yeah, there was an aspect of that, a big aspect of that. It turns out there was lots of little nuances with their directions that were interesting. Many things have changed since 1916. Isostatic rebound means that points that were formerly close to the shoreline are now nowhere near the shoreline. In the early years of the study, and all the directions are based off large boulders, which you just find around the landscape, which was all probably well and good 100 years ago, but you can't see them now. They're covered with vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult to orient yourself. The coastline looks very different. All of their directions are based on pacing and magnetic north. Magnetic north changes. So their compass directions are all off. Paces are not the most standardized unit of metrics.
Right.
But it was very Indiana Jones-esque. At one point, we were looking for a large rock with an X painted on
there
it.
There you go.
And I'm not even kidding. I mean, it's a cross, but, you know, sideways.
Still.
So, you know, X cross marked the spot.
Pretty amazing. And did you find all 9 plots?
We did.
There's and how did you decipher it?
We did. There's only 8 plots left. So he installed 9, but one of the plots was lost in the 1930s. So we knew we weren't looking for that one. And it was actually lost when ice calving off one of the glaciers that was still retreating and close by washed the bluff that the plot was installed on away. So we were looking for 8. But we were able to find them because back in the 20s, Cooper had put in iron spikes on the corners of his plots. And those spikes are buried now, but we had a metal detector, so we were able to find them with a metal detector.
Wow.
So we were able to locate their exact location.
Now, when you found the plots, so the last notes on these in 1988, mm-hmm. what had happened in the 20 mm-hmm. years?
25 years, yeah. Not as much as you'd think, and less than I would think. In fact, one of them is crazy. There's a fern, like a maidenhair fern, and so I should first describe the plots. They're about a square meter, but they didn't just write down what was in them. They mapped it out exactly. So they sketched out, like, in this part of the square, there is, you know, this plant, and in that plant spot, there's
this
individual.
Or a little this.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Little, yeah, right.
And so in 1982 and the 1988, they had sketched out a maidenhair fern, which is this beautiful fern, delicate fern you find around town. It's still there. There's a 36-year-old fern still there. So in many ways, it hasn't changed. And in other ways, it's changed quite a bit. So you can see through their notes, and then through photographs, and then through our data, you can see alders grow up, lean over, fall down, and actually decay. And you can watch it through time. And so, like, they have logs sitting on their plots or limbs sitting on their plots, which are now gone. They've decomposed mm-hmm. away, for example.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. And that was part of what I was going to ask. What were some of the landmark things that he discovered? What are some of the main points of discovery that he made in the 70-year kind of original study?
Yeah, so between Cooper and Lawrence, some of their big contributions were this idea that plants could facilitate the establishment of other plants. So, in other words, certain species could come in and do things to the environment that made other species more likely to succeed. For example, they stabilized the ground.
Which is interesting because that's I just as a layperson kind of know that.
Yeah, you do now.
Right,
yeah,
do now.
Yeah,
right.
It's filtered into our consciousness.
That's even part of highway maintenance and things like that, right? You plant these things in order to stop erosion and that kind of thing.
And
but,
so the idea that this would lead to predictable change, or at least semi-predictable change, he was the first one to start really trying to put data to those. You know, those ideas we take for granted.
Yeah.
Nitrogen fixation is another one, if you've heard of that. Like, the reason we plant peas and things is to get nitrogen into the soil. And there's certain plants that do that. And they were some of the first to discover nitrogen-fixing plants.
These are some of the things that we learned the hard way during the Dust Bowl and some other, you know, agricultural kind of developments through the years. But he was
to see how
on the forefront of discovering. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, to see how key they were in these sorts of natural processes.
Wow. Well, Brian Buma, fascinating stuff. Thanks so much for talking to me about it. You'll be doing 2 lectures about this and providing a lot more information and photos and all that kind
of
stuff and all that stuff. Yeah, and maybe some maps and maybe
yes,
right. Maybe one, maybe just slip one Nazi in there. Jones, that one, the one with the face melting. That'd be great.
Maybe I'll do that. Yeah.
Just face melt someone at the end.
Yeah, that'll wake them up. Yeah, that'll be the first slide just to make sure everyone's paying attention.
That'd be good. Never open the ark. You'll be doing that tonight. 6:30 is the first lecture out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, and then there's a second one at 8 o'clock. I always let people know to get there early because seating's limited and these things are often packed out. Once again, Brian Buma talking about the world's oldest ecological land study, the work of William Cooper. Brian, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know all about it. Sounds fascinating.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks. The Fall doing their version of the Kinks' Victoria, and we're in the studio with Catholic Community Services folks. Kelly Wood is here, and Aaron Walker-Tolis is with me as well. Thanks to both of you for coming in. You guys, as always, Catholic Community Services has a ton of stuff going on, lots of different programs within the umbrella network of what Catholic Community Services funds and runs and all that stuff. So let's talk about those things, and then you got a fun event coming up that we want to talk about, too. But let's talk about the services first and foremost. Let's kind of go over some of the things. So what are the main components of what Catholic Community Services covers in Juneau?
Well, we have a large body of our work is Southeast Senior Services, and I'm going to let Kelsey talk about that. But Hospice and Home Care of Juneau is one of our best-known programs. Hospice providing end-of-life care for people in their own home so they can have the end of their life be the most positive experience it can be. We provide bereavement counseling for their family and themselves. We also have home health services, so that's nursing, skilled nursing, and therapists like occupational therapy, speech therapy, and physical therapy coming into people's homes. Folks who can't get out easily, we come to them and provide those services. So we're kind of excited right now. We've got a really great staff. We've got a lot of things happening, and we're seeing our program grow for the first time in a long time. So we're excited because we're helping more people than in previous years, and we're hoping to continue that trend moving forward.
Yeah, it's been so, I work out at the brewery, as you know, and we got to partner with you guys in this past year to choose you as our nonprofit partner, and that was such a cool experience because I got to understand more about what hospice and home care really covered, you know, not just end-of-life services, which are obviously incredibly important and a lot of people know you for, but also like speech therapy that happens in the home and things like that, just these kind of basic things that help people that, want home care, need counseling services, need those kinds of services, and you provide that.
We do, and it's such a meaningful experience. And some of the things we do, folks, they don't even know the breadth of what we can do for them to make things, their life a little easier, a little better.
Yeah.
You know, even speech therapy, even for folks on hospice, we had somebody who was having problems speaking because of their terminal illness, and our speech therapist figured out some assistive technology so that they could communicate with their family down south by phone for the first time in months.
Well, that's so important. And,
it really
yeah,
is.
Right.
It really is. So we're excited to see that we're reaching more people, and that's our plan, is to keep growing those programs.
Yeah, and then Kelly, senior services, that's sort of your area of expertise.
So, Southeast Senior Services covers a lot of things. There's 11 senior centers that we operate within Southeast Alaska. We have the Bridge Adult Day Program in Juneau, which I wanted to plug because we have openings right now. There's no wait list, and if you're not familiar with that program, it's a program for anyone over the age of 60 or people of any age who are experiencing Alzheimer's or related dementia, just folks that might need a little bit more assistance during the day. And so what the Bridge offers is a way for them to get out, be a part of the community, take part in some activities, and then it also allows caregivers to work or do things to take care of themselves, as we know that's so important for caregivers. So it's a care option that's available in Juneau that not a lot of people know about and are utilizing. So I wanted to put that out there.
And then the senior services, is that strictly limited to the centers, or are there other services that happen that are outside of the centers? Or
there's Meals on Wheels. There's case management. I'm sure I'll forget something. basically, if you know a senior that needs help with something, call us. If we don't know how to help them, we know someone who does. So.
And is it based on income needs and based on those kinds of things, or are there other considerations, or just any senior who you know needs help with something?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and of course, that includes Caravan here in Juneau, and we do paratransit in Sitka, in Ketchikan, in all of the communities that we have a senior center. We also have transportation, and again, that is free. It's regardless of income. It's grant-funded or contract-funded. We've got about, I don't know, 83 grants all smooshed together, lots of partners, tribal partners,
right.
City partners, and we provide those services. With that, we encourage donations, of course, contributions, but ultimately we just provide those services because they're needed.
So many different things that you kind of don't realize touch different people's lives in a lot of different ways. So you see the caravan driving around all over town, and, that's this organization that's doing that also does this and this and this. And so, amazing. So we'll go ahead and just right now, we'll do it at the end too, but give me that number that people can call if they have questions.
Sure. So there's a 1-800 number that I don't know off the top of my head, but for the Bridge program specifically, the phone number is 463-6171.
Okay, great. Terrific. And just ask for... Just ask your question, I guess, right.
And then we also operate a senior and caregiver resource center here in Juneau, and that's located in the St. Anne's building. There's normally somebody in that office that can also help answer questions and direct you.
Okay, great. Now let's talk about Classy and Sassy.
Oh, Classy and Sassy. So this is our second annual gala, and we're like super excited. Last year we did and said, okay, we haven't done a gala. We're going to do a gala and see how it goes. And you were there.
I was.
You are MC, which
was
awesome.
I was, yes.
And so we really liked it. We had a great time, and we decided, okay, we're going to do this for Realsies bigger. So what we did is one of the things we figured out at the last gala was we had sort of two different kind of groups of people there. We had some older folks who were really enjoying the classy live music, very classy kind of thing. And then we had some younger folks trickle in a little bit later on and go, well, this is really nice, very, very, very nice, but when are we going to boogie?
Right.
I mean, when are we
going
to shake it? And we talked about it afterwards. Why can't we do both? We can be all things. And so what we're going to do is we're starting at 7 at Elizabeth Paradovich Hall on Saturday, the 3rd of February, and we're starting out with the Juneau 5 Jazz Quintet, and they're going to, again, classy, we're going to have the buffet food and food by Breezin, beer courtesy of Alaska Brewery, all donated, and that's special money going straight to hospice, of course, and then at 9 o'clock, we're going to switch it up. DJ Manu's going to come in, and we're going to change the whole feel of the party, and we're going to party.
All right.
So it's you can have it all. And we're going to have an auction this time. And we've got Alaska Airline tickets. We've got two tickets to fly Alaska Seaplanes over to Huna and do the zip line, and three nights in Sitka. We've got some good stuff.
Those are fun, yeah.
Yeah, we've got stuff for all price ranges because, you know, we want to go to it too, and we want our staff to go to it. And, you know, you work at a nonprofit. You're not swimming in dough usually. So we want to make sure everyone can enjoy coming to this event and be part of the auction too.
Yeah,
so,
it sounds like a blast. Made for everyone, yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, start pinkies out. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then, yeah,
oh,
shake the leg and everything else out.
It's like white and silver and black. It's very classy. Then we're going to turn the strobe lights on, and everything's going to be colored lights, and we're going to dunka. It's going to be cool.
Unce, right? Yeah,
exactly,
right.
Except like that. Right. We'll try. I don't know that I could do it, but others can.
Sounds good. All right, well, that's classy and sassy. That's happening February 3rd. How do people get tickets and that kind of thing?
You know, we're doing this through our website, so ccsjuno.org, and you can buy your tickets right there. You're welcome to come to the St. Anne's building and say hi to us, and we'll give you a paper ticket, but you can just go online at $75 a ticket or $550 for a table of eight. And so just encourage people. I know there's a lot going on over the weekend, but consider us as one of your exciting and fun options. We really, really want folks to come and celebrate with us.
All right, happening next Saturday the 3rd, and more information on that, ccsjuno.org. More information, I'm sure, on all the services that happen at Catholic Community Services there, including senior services, hospice and home care, and everything else that you folks do. Kelly Wood and Aaron Walker-Tolis, thanks so much for coming in and telling us all about it, and have a great, fun, I might see you
at the gala.
Yes, I might
be
there.
That would be awesome.
At the gala event as well. Thanks so much for both of you for coming in.
Thank you.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. It's easy to share a little of your PFD with Southeast Communities through Pick, Click, Give. There are dozens of nonprofits that you can support in Juneau alone, including KTOO Public Media. The application period for the PFD begins January 1st and runs through March 31st. For more information, go to pickclickgive.org. Higher education can really pay off with better earnings over the course of your career. But how do you pay for that education to begin with? The Financial Aid Office at the University of Alaska Southeast has the answers you are looking for. Find eligible scholarships, apply for financial aid awards, and learn strategies to get the most out of your investment in yourself and in your future. Call 796-6100 and ask to speak to an advisor today. This message is brought to you by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you as the host, and I've got a crowd of folks here now in the studio with me, all students that are exchange students through AFS. So welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Hello. So let me, I'll get first and foremost. We've got, what if we have seven different students here in the studio with me?
Eight.
Sorry, eight. That's who you're dealing with right here. Not too good. So let's just start over on this side of the room. Just get everyone to maybe step up. Tell me where you're staying right now, what town you're staying in, and where you're from, and what your name is.
Well, I'm Carlos. I'm from Paraguay, and I'm staying here at Juno.
Okay.
In the Valley.
Great.
And I'm going to TM.
Okay, cool.
My name is Manuel. I live here in Juno. I'm from Spain, and I also go GM.
Okay. Hi.
I'm Debbie from Hong Kong, and I'm staying in Haines right now.
Okay.
I'm Katya. I'm from Germany, and I'm staying at JD, and I'm living in the Valley, too.
Okay, cool. Hi.
Hi, I'm Shantula. I'm from Pakistan, and I live in Sitka right now.
Okay.
I'm Haifa from Jordan, and we live in Sitka, too.
Okay.
I'm Ceren from Turkey, and I'm living in Sitka, too.
Hi.
Hi, yeah, I'm Omar, and I'm living in Sitka, too. I'm from Egypt.
Egypt. Okay, wow, what a great representation of the world here. It's kind of incredible, right? So I'll just maybe start on this end over here. How did I'll pick on you from Spain. Yes. How did you find out about the AFS program and kind of get connected to figuring out you wanted to be an exchange student?
Well, I have family working in AFS, and I have cousins that were coming in exchange this year, I'm doing. So they asked me if I wanted to come, and I said yes.
And then did you know, when they asked you, did you know Alaska was going to be where you ended up?
No. You just chose one country.
They don't
tell you anything else.
Is that the same for you?
Yeah, we're just choosing, we're going to the United States, but we don't know which state we're going to.
So just step on up a little bit closer. So tell me what was your reaction when you found out Alaska was going to be the place you were going to go?
I was pretty shocked because I thought they sent me to the wrong place because I thought I'm going to Canada.
Uh-huh.
That's why I'm so
sure
confused.
I'm sure that's a common mistake, yeah.
Yeah, but it's awesome to go to Alaska, though.
Cool. And what did you think? Coming from Pakistan, it must be a bit of a difference, right,
yeah,
to go to Alaska. Did you have a lot of knowledge about Alaska before?
Before I got this, no. But after I got this, I kind of searched about it. People told me about it.
Right.
And they were like, but they were wrong. They were like, there are igloos and bears and I don't know what. They were like, you're going to live on a glacier in an igloo. And that's not how it is.
No, right. Yes. That'd be kind of awesome, you know, if that was.
Yeah.
But that's not how it is. Yeah. So that's interesting. So what are some of the things when you came over here, when you met other students here, what were some of the perceptions they had about where you're from? You're from Egypt.
Yeah, that's right.
So what do people think? Do they think, oh, you live in pyramids and is it the same kind of misperceptions?
Yeah, so one of the common questions that I have been asked is, do you have a camel? So, no, we are not living in the desert. We have moles. It's like we have life as here too. I mean, I don't have a camel. I didn't ride a camel before.
Right.
So, and we have many things like beside the pyramids.
Yeah,
the pyramids one of the one of the popular things. But I mean, we have different things too.
Sure. Yeah, it's a huge country with a diverse culture.
That's right.
Right. So, and then maybe I'll ask you, here's one question I have for you. What's the most common question that you get when you're first introduced and you're from Turkey, right? What's the most common thing people ask you?
Actually, it's kind of the same, not so many people, but a kind of camel are you using for transportation?
Really?
Like that on also.
It feels like that's an insulting question, though, doesn't it? In a way, it's such a misperception.
Yeah.
Right?
I know.
Yeah.
And also, I remember not a question, but like in Thanksgiving, all people make a joke like turkey and turkey. We have like turkey. So.
Yeah.
Okay,
right.
Stop.
Funny. Puns. Yes. So, how about you coming from Jordan? Is there a specific question? I mean, I think that's an interesting. You know, there's been a lot of political strife happening lately. Does that come up a lot for you?
Surprisingly enough,
no.
Do you ride camels to school? Is also the case here.
Really?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. You know, I would just think that especially kids in Alaska would kind of have a perception that. Well, we don't all live in igloos, so obviously, but still, people just have this, I mean, I think we just must have such little knowledge of all these different places where you guys are, different every single place you're from. Yeah, it's fascinating. Well, coming from Europe, from Germany, what part of Germany are you from? Are you from a colder climate part of Germany?
I'm from the west, North Rhine-Westphalia.
Okay. So the climate change probably isn't too big a deal.
It's not too big.
Yeah, not too big a deal for you to adjust to that. Are there things that you found when you got here that was a surprise? About
yeah, pretty small.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I can't take this. City bus, like, only 5 minutes, yeah.
Right, so okay. Just moving to small town Alaska is a big adjustment for you. I'm sure coming from Hong Kong, that must be a massive adjustment. Are you from urban, right in the kind of urban area of Hong Kong?
Hong Kong is pretty small, so, like, everything is squished together. So it's not that big, actually. It's, like, kind of the size of the Haynesborough. But we live like 7 million people in that area.
Right.
So it's pretty new for me to live in a small town, actually. It's pretty fun.
It's fun. You like it?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. It must feel, though, limiting in some ways, right? I mean, there's a million things to do in Hong Kong, right?
Well, in Haynes, I learned how to make my own fun stuff.
Yeah. You just have to learn how to...
Yeah. It's fun to, like, play with the snow and stuff like that. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, that's cool. And then how's life in the valley? You liking it?
Yeah, I'm really enjoying my experience so far.
Yeah, and you go to Thunder Mountain?
Yeah.
And were there things coming, I mean, what were some of the perceptions you had coming in ahead of time that you felt like haven't come to be? In other words, like, did you have perceptions about what it was going to be like to live in Juneau?
Actually, I thought it would be colder.
Colder, yeah. Right. We're having a warm winter, but December was pretty cold.
Yeah.
Did you get to go like ice skating for the first time? Things like that, or?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, cool.
Some cold activities. Yeah. Snow and ice and stuff.
Right. Well, what are some of the things that you feel like you want to take home to your friends and to family and the people you know when your time here is done? What are some of the things that you want to bring back about what life is in Alaska or in America, that sort of thing?
So kind of I will try to find like 7 years that describe the culture in Alaska. Just like the totem poles and the native Alaskan. So kind of try to find small things that describe that. And that's going to be maybe the 7 years that I'm going to take when I go back. Yeah.
Is there something that you think was like the coolest thing about Alaska that you want to convey and let people know about?
I think Alaska has a pretty rich culture. When I was back home, in my mind, I didn't thought about the Alaskan culture as American culture. I didn't know about it. But now if you like... Well, I lived in Sitka for like a long time, and I got to know like all the new stuff. I met natives and their culture and all the stuff, and I think it's pretty rare and it's pretty unique. And yeah, I would like to take souvenirs that represent that culture back home.
I think you're right about that being pretty unique in America to have such a close connection to our native culture.
Yeah,
and to have that be a real part of everyday life is really a different. Thing. Yeah. There's not a lot of places like that I've lived in or been around in America.
Yeah.
Is that the way Pakistan is? Does Pakistan have a close link to its kind of more ancient culture?
Yeah, I think like people wear cultural clothing, cultural food. Pakistan is diverse, and because every province has its own language, culture, clothing, food, but we also have a national dress and national language and stuff. So it is diverse, but it is like connected. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think we do have culture is a really important part in Pakistan.
Has there been anything happening like at home? I know in Spain there's been some political unrest and things like that. Have you been trying to keep up with that and know what's going on or keeping in touch with family about those sorts of things?
So yeah, I've been trying to like ask my family what's going on over there, but like there's so many things that they just like can't talk to me about everything.
It's just a really complex issue.
Yeah.
Is that what you? Yeah, right. So there's so many different things happening every day mm-hmm. as far as that separatist movement that's happening. Yeah. Are you from that area?
No, I'm not. I live in Northwest.
Okay, it's just kind of across the country.
Yeah, it's just across the country.
Right, right. How about you in Germany? Are there things Angela Merkel does something and it's like, oh, well, that's really interesting? Are you keeping up with those kinds of...
I try to keep up with my family, but it's really hard also, yeah.
I know that my wife was a exchange student, and she had a very similar experience where at the last second she said, well, maybe I'd also go to the Southern Hemisphere. And she thought that meant, oh, I'll probably end up in Australia. She ended up in Peru, in a tiny city in Peru. So it was the first exchange student who'd ever come to the city, and it was completely immersive in Spanish. She had taken German for 4 years. So she wasn't ready. But because of that, it was very immersive. But in those days, because I'm old, there was no way to really contact family. And I know they place restrictions on how much you're allowed to contact family. Maybe can you tell me about that? What are some of the parameters for making sure that you're trying to immerse as much as possible in the culture that you're exchanging with?
Yeah. So we're supposed to only have 1 hour of internet each day. But like,
that's probably pretty hard to control, right?
It is very hard to control, right. Especially when, like, homesickness.
Yeah, sure.
And stuff like that. Yeah, but also you do have to focus on your life and not texting and, you know, video calling your family is part of, you know, gaining a little bit of independence on your exchange. So we're aware of that, and we try our best to stick to that, too.
How many of you, just like show of hands, were really pretty proficient in English before you got here? Because you're all very proficient now. So you've kind of really learned this much English in just the 6 months or so you've been here? Is that right? Because you're all doing awesome, you know? So that's really impressive. That sort of does show that thing of really immersing in a culture and living someplace is so much the way to get all the subtleties of what it is to communicate in these different languages. Well, thanks so much to all of you for coming in and talking to me about this. It's the AFS program. AFS USA is the high school student exchange program, and it's this kind of exchange of diversity, I guess, is what they call the AFS effect. Have you heard that, right? Yes.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. Thanks so much for coming in to all
thank
of you.
You for
and,
thank you.
Thanks for being a great part of our community here in Southeast Alaska. We appreciate it. Coming up right now, here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. For most birds, keen eyesight is absolutely critical for finding food, spotting predators, and generally staying alive. But many birds lead lives that could be very hard on the eyes, like flying at breakneck speed, racing for cover into a dense thicket, or diving underwater to catch a spiny, struggling fish. Fortunately, birds have evolved a structure for protecting their eyes. Like humans, they have upper and lower outer eyelids. But beneath the outer eyelids lies an extra eyelid called the nictitating membrane. Nictitating, for all its alliterative syllables, simply means blinking. This extra eyelid is hinged on the inner side of the eye and sweeps horizontally across the cornea. The nictitating membrane is largely transparent, and it helps keep the eye moist and clean while guarding it from wind, dust, and hazards. Birds aren't the only animals gifted with nature's goggles. Reptiles and some mammals have the extra eyelid, too. A polar bear's nictitating membrane helps protect its eyes against the intense glare of Arctic light, preventing snow blindness. Nature's goggles become nature's sunglasses. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. Support for BirdNote comes from Bloomsbury, announcing the new book Winter Birds, with paintings by artist and ornithologist Lars Johnson, available wherever books are sold.
Just move on up toward your destination. Though you may find from time to time complications.
All right, there's no debate that Curtis Mayfield is awesome. And that was Curtis Mayfield with Move On Up. But we are debating here right now in the studio because we have members of the drama, debate, and forensics team from Thunder Mountain High School and the coach, Christina Apathy. Christina, thanks so much for bringing in some of your talented members of your team here.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate
I'm actually
it.
The co-coach of this
co-coach
team.
Co-coach with?
Mr. Chris Knight is the debate coach.
All right. Very good. Well, Xander, Morgan, and Alex have joined us here. So, Xander, I'll just turn to you first. You're part of the
debate portion.
Team. Okay. So, let's ask you what debate specifically is about, and then we'll ask Morgan and Alex a little bit more about the other elements of this. So, what is debate all about?
So, debate is basically we get a topic or a resolve, and it usually revolves around something that's like a topical issue, like. For instance, we've done things relating to nuclear war and gun control and paying student athletes. And so we take this topic and basically we have to research whether and it's basically like we should or we should not do this. And so all the teams across Southeast research these topics and, you know, research both pro and con so that they can argue both. And then they come to meets and then they debate it out.
So that's a really interesting part about debate to me, right, which is that you have to argue not necessarily your personal beliefs. In fact, you don't argue
your personal beliefs.
You have to argue the value and the validity of both sides of the argument.
Exactly. Right? And you have to do as much research on pro as you do on con. And you may, if someone chooses pro and you're really good at pro, you're going to have to argue con and you're going to have to go for it.
Do you find that that's the way it breaks out, that you can that people can be really good at pro no matter what pro is? That's what they're really good at? Or
maybe. I mean, there's been times where I think I've been better at pro or better at con. You know, it just... Because sometimes, I mean, you might just feel a connection to an issue, or there might just be more evidence stacked on the pro side. You know, it's not always fair. It's not always equal, like pro and con. Sometimes it's like, you know, it's more stacked on the pro side or it's more stacked on the con side. But you have to do your best for both sides.
Wow, very cool. Okay, so Morgan, I'll turn to you next. And you're part of what section of this?
The drama section.
Drama section. Okay, so what happens in the drama section that's apart from, say, being in a play or something like that?
Well, in the drama section, you pick your events, and there's a bunch of events to pick from, like duo and duet and DIs and stuff, and you only get a set amount of time on this stage kind of thing, and a judge judges you and your piece, and then you compete against other pieces and stuff.
And so it's just like dramatic readings, dramatic acting, and these are they things that you've always had a chance to prepare, or do sometimes are things thrown at you? Is that a portion that can happen? Or?
You're allowed to pick your own pieces and prepare for them.
Okay.
Yes.
And are they always, are there pieces that are kind of, can you just pick anything you want?
They or just have it, to be published.
Okay, published pieces. Oh, okay, interesting. What are some of the ones that you really felt a connection to and have picked?
Well, I really feel a connection to Night Mother, which is a piece I'm doing now. And if you guys come to the showcase tonight, you might be able to see it.
That's good. Yeah. I could drop that in there. It's showcase and fundraiser tonight for this happening, right, Christina? Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Or Xander or whoever wants to answer that. Yeah.
Yep. Tonight, yeah. 7 o'clock.
Okay.
You'll repeat it again at Thunder Mountain High School auditorium.
Sounds good. All right. And Alex, what portion of this do you do? Do you drama as well? Or?
Yeah, I'm also part of the drama portion.
And you were just describing right before we got on mic, you were describing the kind of the parts of that. How does that break down?
So debate is, as Xander explained, the teams come together and they debate a pro and a con side. For the drama side, there's a bunch of scenes that you can do. There's a lot of one-person scenes. There's a few two-person scenes. And then there's what's called Reader's Theater, where it's, I think the max is 5 or 6 people, and you can go up and you have actually stands and you have your script with you, but it's a lot more limited movement, so that makes it a lot more difficult. And then in the forensic side, it's kind of gathering evidence and then speaking on it. There's original oratory, which you have to gather evidence and then speak for a maximum of, I think, either 8 or 10 minutes, I'm not sure, and it has to be a persuasive speech, so you have to be trying to convince your audience to do something. Then there's expository speaking, which is kind of like original oratory, except for it's just a informational speech. And then there's extemporaneous commentary and extemporaneous speaking. Extemporaneous commentary, you're given a random topic, which can range from purple to pencil, and you have to come up with a random speech on that that isn't always necessarily factual. It just has to be entertaining, and you have to grip the judge. And then extemporaneous speaking is actual events that are, your topic is an event that's going on in the world, and you have to be knowledgeable of that. So there's a lot less people that do extemporaneous speaking, just because that's a lot more rigorous and requires a lot more knowledge.
You don't get any time to research it. You do have time, very limited time, but you can't look things up on your computer. A lot of it's knowledge from your head.
They just say immigration policy, go.
And you're like, ah, and you're I don't know anything.
Or you make it up and go. What are some of the things that you, when you talk about all these different things, there's some obvious ways that this leads for people. I think law, for instance, obviously people think when they think about debate and think about speaking like that, a lot of people think, well, that'd be terrific if I wanted to go into the law. But what are some of the other things that have you thought about how this might lead you in the future?
Well, yes, actually. I kind of want to go into some drama productions as I grow up and stuff. And also, even if I wasn't going to be in the drama industry, I still think that at some point you're going to have to do public speaking, whether it's at a meeting with your boss or something. And I feel like DDF really, really prepares us for that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, communications is a big part of what we have to do. Yes, extemporaneous. Was it
extemporaneous?
Extemporaneous speaking is what I do best.
That's
kind of what I do. So, and let me ask you, Xander, just a little bit more about what some of the favorite things that you've gotten to debate when you've done this?
My favorite thing to debate.
Or topic that was that one I feel like I really nailed that one, or that was a really interesting one, or that one was really tough.
I think the most, not the most fun I had, but I think the one I was best at was gun control for me. I feel like that debate had a lot of evidence and a lot of resources, and there were some super divisive elements of it, but there was also a lot you could dig in, and there's a lot of, I did a lot of research on that one.
And that's one where you can definitely, I think that both sides of that argument can probably be so articulated and have so much of a history of being articulated.
Totally.
Yeah, right. Do you want to say something, Christina?
To say that these kids have been working since September on these pieces. And they've been rehearsing 2 or sometimes even 3 times a week if they're involved in both debate and drama. We have some people who do both.
Yeah.
And they've been traveling around just like a sports team does. Every month we go to a different town in Southeast. And tonight it's just about celebrating everybody's work and thanking the community for supporting us. And so tonight it's about a 2-hour long show.
And how many folks in the drama and debate and forensics team all together are there?
So we're about 20.
Oh, wow.
I would say 17 to 20. It varies because people can choose not to go to a meet one month. Yeah, but we're about 20 people all together.
And when you do debate team, for instance, is there a minimum number that's required to have the team?
Well, we're in groups of two for the most part.
Okay.
Because for the most part in Southeast, we do public forum debate, which is basically it's a lot to explain, but there's two people for each side, so you'll have groups of two, one doing pro, one doing con, and they would you like me to explain public forum debate or
you know what, we don't have time to explain public
All right.
forum debate, but
it's a complicated thing.
Here's what I would say, right? Yeah. Anyone who's interested in any of these elements should go tonight, 7 o'clock, to Thunder Mountain High School.
Totally.
Check out what you're showcasing, all the skills that you guys have and some of the stuff you guys have done, and then also fundraising, so
yeah.
Please contribute as well, right?
And
I
also think that it's like this debate is actually going to be really entertaining. Like it's not like it's not a public forum debate, it's a world's debate, so it's more free and it's more loose, and we're more just like having fun instead of like trying to win something. So I think like you'll find enjoyment in that as well as like the drama pieces, which some of them are absolutely like phenomenal.
Cool.
Like seriously.
Very cool.
Yeah.
It's happening tonight, Thunder Mountain High School. Go check it out.
Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.